Chapter 25. Bobby wove his way through Boston traffic, grill lights flashing as he worked his way south to Roxbury. He had spent longer than he'd intended in Annabelle's apartment. Done more than he'd intended in Annabelle's apartment. Hell, came damn close to behaving like a total ass in Annabelle's apartment. But he was back in his car, in control, and reacquainting himself with cold, hard reality. He was a detective. He was working a major case, and things were sliding from bad to worse. Someone knew about the locket. According to the note, that person would meet only with Sergeant D.D. Warren, who was supposed to bring the necklace to the deserted grounds of Boston State Mental at 3:33 a.m. tonight. Failure to comply would result in immediate repercussions. Another young girl would die. Bobby's reaction to the note had been instinctive and informed by nearly a decade of tactical team training. Clusterfuck. Someone was playing with them, but that did not mean the consequences of disobeying wouldn't be real. He hit Ruggles Street driving with one hand, working his cell phone with the other. He had a callback from MIT with the contact info for one Paul Shupp, former head of mathematics. Another call from a rental agency that had handled Annabelle's former home on Oak Street. More people to call here, more leads to chase there. He did the best he could in the 10 minutes he had before reaching HQ. Dusk had descended, the low ceiling of gray clouds making the hour seem later than it was. Commuters trudged along either side of the street, hidden beneath umbrellas or shrouded in dark raincoats. Living so close to police headquarters had made them oblivious to sirens, and not a single person bothered to look up as he passed. Finally, up ahead, lights blazing, the glass and steel monstrosity of police headquarters firing to life for another long night. Bobby punched end on his cell phone and prepared to get serious. Parking in Roxbury was no laughing matter. At first pass, the street side spaces were filled. Bobby still didn't turn into central parking, and not just because the police parking lot was a notorious spot for getting mugged. Like most of the detectives, he wanted to be properly positioned for a quick getaway should something unexpected occur. That meant parking as close to the building as possible. Third time was the charm. A fellow officer pulled out, and Bobby ducked into the vacated space. He already had his ID in hand as he trotted for the building. 6:07 p.m. Dee Dee probably had the rest of the team in place by now, discussing strategy for the 3:33 a.m. rendezvous. Should they bring the original locket? Risk reprisals by producing a substitute? They would attempt the handoff. Bobby had no doubt about that. It was too good an opportunity to flush their quarry into the open. Plus, Dee Dee didn't have enough sense to be afraid. Bobby cruised through security, swiped his ID through the reader, and hit the stairwell, taking the steps two at a time. He needed the exercise. It allowed him to work off the worst of his adrenaline, and the buzz he was still feeling from kissing a woman he never should have kissed. Don't go there. Have a mission. Stay on task. He'd just cleared the stairwell door, was debating sprinting down the long corridor toward the homicide unit in a mad dash against himself, when the door directly across from him opened up and Dee Dee stuck her head out. He jumped self-consciously. The task force meeting's in there? He asked in confusion, trying to figure out why they had moved. Dee Dee, however, was shaking her head. Team's meeting in 30 minutes. Aola's parents just arrived. Join the party. Don't say a word. Bobby's brows shot up. He joined the party. He didn't say a word. Bobby had never been in this central conference room before. Much nicer digs than the glorified walk-in closets the homicide suite had to offer. One glance, and Bobby understood the upscale room choice. The Aeolas hadn't just brought themselves, but their people, and their people's people, to judge from the crowd. It took him 5 minutes to sort it out. Across from him, to his left, sat a gentleman, age anywhere between 80 and 100, in a dark gray suit, with a sparse horseshoe head of hair, parchment-thin skin, and a hooked patrician's nose, Christopher Aeola's father, Christopher Sr. To his right, sat a frail, liver-spotted female in navy blue Chanel and golf ball-size pearls, Christopher Aeola's mother, Pauline,